Jenny Macherry is presented by the Writers and Illustrators of the Future. They've been providing a means for new and budding writers to have a chance for the creative efforts to be seen and acknowledged. Welcome to Chatting with Sherry. Tonight we welcome back crime novelist, editor, and the president of the Detection Club, Martin Edwards. We're going to talk about his new book that's coming out. It's The Mystery, of course. And we are going to talk about his editor, the book he edited that's also coming out. And we're going to talk about the Golden Age of Mysteries, and which is between World War I and World War II. And we talked about a lot of stuff. We had so much fun last time we came on. I had to ask him back. Here's Martin. Hi, Martin. Welcome back to the show.
Hello, Sherry. Well, thanks very much for inviting me back. It's a great honor, so lovely to be talking to you again.
Thank you. It's a great honor to talk to you, too. I love your stuff. I love your writing. You're very talented.
Well, that's very kind. I'm writing busily at the moment. I'm glad to say. So looking forward to bringing out more books before very long.
So you have several new ones on the horizon?
I have a number of different things happening at present. I've got another novel in my series about Rachel Savernate, which I've just finished, and I've just received the copy edited manuscript yesterday, so I've got to go through that and check it, but there doesn't seem to be much to do, so that will come out in the UK in September, but in the US the previous book will be coming out I think around that time, the previous book in the series, which in the States is called The House on Graveyard Lane.
Oh, cool.
In Britain it's called Sepulchre Street, but they decided to have a different title in America. So that's the fourth book that's coming out in the States this year, and say the fifth book will come out in Britain at roughly the same time this September.
Isn't it interesting that they still do that? That they have one name for the States and another name for the UK?
Yes, it's happened to me. I think this is the third time it's happened to me with my American editions. There was one book in the Lake District Mysteries series, which I call The Crooked Shore, which in the States became The Girl I All Forgot. Very different sort of title.
Yeah.
Sort of vibe.
It has a totally different kind of meaning.
Oh, it's... yes, I am quite attached to my own titles, I must confess. And then in the Rachel Savernake series, the first two, Gallows Court and Mortmain Hall, had the same titles in America. But the third one, which I call Blackstone Fell, that was the title that used in the UK. In the States, it became The Puzzle of Blackstone Lodge. And as I say, Sepulchre Street is going to become The House on Graveyard Lane. So the fifth book is going to be called Hemlock Bay. And that's the British title. But I'm hoping that will also be the American title. But I don't know for sure yet.
I mean, Americans know what hemlock is, so I don't see why it should change.
I'll be keeping my fingers crossed.
I mean, to me, the Blackstone title, I don't see why they had two different titles. It really is the same thing. I don't really get it.
Yeah, I think that, you see, in Britain, it's well known that a fell is a hill or a small mountain, whereas I think that the American publishers were worried that that might not be quite as well known in the States. I think that was the main reason for it, but I think Blackstone Fell was a good title, and that's how I think of it. But as I say, it's the Puzzle of Blackstone Lodge in the States.
And then also could be that I read a lot of the English literature, and then I knew what fell meant.
Yeah, well, that could well be. Yes, I know you do read a great many, so that could explain it.
But. Yeah, in fact, what was the one that I read recently. It was a Lorik that had Fel in it.
I can't remember. Oh, yes, Fel Murder.
That's it.
Yes, British, yeah. The British Library Crime Classic.
That was a
ECR Lorak.
Really yeah. good book. Really, I so yeah. enjoyed it. But
oh, I'm glad to hear that.
Oh, I loved yes, it. I love Lorik. I think of the new discoveries I've made, Lorik is my favorite.
Oh well, I'm truly delighted to hear that because I tried for years to get Lorak republished, and it was quite difficult to find out who owned the rights to the books. But fortunately, the British Library persisted. It did take 3 or 4 years, but I was introduced to Lorak by my parents. Actually, because they liked the Lorak books, and they particularly liked the ones set in Loonsdale around Morecambe Bay, because they knew that area very well. It wasn't so far from where they lived, and in fact, my grandmother lived in Morecambe, actually on Morecambe Bay, and that was the first place I ever went on holiday to when I was a very, very small child indeed. So it had that nostalgic thing about it. And for many years, when I was going around secondhand bookshops, if I saw a Lorak book, because they'd been out of print for a very long time, so you couldn't really get them at all in those days. So I would buy the secondhand books and then give them to my parents. And they're no longer with us now, sadly. So I now have all those books, and she was very prolific and very varied and interesting, I think. So I've been truly delighted that those books have achieved so much success, because you're not alone, Sherry, because many, many people get in touch with me to say that Lorax are really either one of their favourites in the series or their absolute favourite. So that is the reason why the British Library has continued to publish quite a number, and I'm quite sure that it will be publishing more in the future.
Oh, I really enjoy it. I love MacDonald. I think he's adorable.
Yeah.
And he's so sweet. You know, because you know some inspectors aren't, and he's a, yeah. just a sweetheart. I really like yeah. him so much. And
yes, he's a good character.
Yeah, right now I'm reading These Names Make Clues.
Oh yes, that's a very interesting book.
I just started it, so yes, don't tell me anything.
Yes, well, I won't spoil the story at all, of course, but. But I think that what I can say is that she wrote that just after she became a member of the Detection Club.
Really?
Yes. Huh? And I think that inspired her to write that particular book. That experience of meeting fellow crime writers, probably for about the first time. Because, of course, there weren't the festivals then of crime writing that there are today.
Yeah.
And the reason the Detection Club was formed in the first place was that so certain leading crime writers could meet each other. And it was a very small group, but she was elected in the late 1930s. And after a fairly short time, she became the secretary of the club.
Wow.
And she was an enthusiastic member right to the end of her life in the late 1950s.
And I remember, I think you told the story on another show, or my show, I don't remember which, about how people were surprised she was a girl.
Yes. There was a well-known crime writer and critic called Harry Keating, who wrote in one of his books, one of his non-fiction books, that he was astonished when he discovered that Lorak wasn't male. And Harry Keating was a very, very sharp guy who read an awful lot of crime novels. So I always found that interesting. And that was his reaction. And I think, although I'm not sure about this, I think my parents probably thought Lorak was male as well. I don't think we ever discussed it, but I wouldn't be surprised, because there was never a photograph of her on the jacket, never once. And in fact, there are very few photographs of her at all. in existence today, and the publishers on the jackets usually and the reviews usually used to refer to Mr. Lorak, so readers would get that impression. Strange though it may seem, but it's true.
I think it's very interesting. I also think that that was a way to get around bigotry, you know.
That's certainly a reason. And in fact, there were quite a few writers in that period during the Golden Age. Even Agatha Christie thought about using the male pseudonym mm-hmm. at one point, you know. Mm-hmm. Although it never actually happened, but she thought about it. And then you have people like Lucy Mallison, who used the name Anthony Gilbert mm-hmm. Quite famously. Josephine Tay used the name Gordon Daviot for her plays, but also her first mystery novel. E.C.R. Lorak is one of those that was a sort of androgynous name. And later on, she did write quite a lot of books under a female name, pseudonym Carol Carnac. Carol being Lorak spelt backwards, so and Car as in Carol, and then AC as in Lorak. So yes, it was quite a common thing in those days, and I think it was, as you suggest, partly because there was a feeling that it would help them if people thought that the book was being written by a man. So whether that was the case or not, I don't know. But certainly that was the feeling. And that, in fact, Marjorie Allingham wrote three novels under the name of Maxwell March, which is one of those names that could be male, could be female.
Oh, I didn't know that. I never heard that one before.
Yes, they're not very well known books. In fact, I've never read any of them. Yes, she did three books in the 30s. They were light thrillers, and she didn't pay a lot of attention to them, really. She admitted that she just wrote them for the money. But that was what she did. She used the name Maxwell March.
I read a thing about Josephine Tay where they knew she was a woman, the actors in her plays, of course. But they all called her Gordon. I mean, I read an article saying that John Gielgud never called her anything other than Gordon.
Oh, that's right. I'm not sure I knew that, to be honest. But that's, that's very interesting. And it kind of bears out the point that you're making.
And I think it's interesting because theater is much more easygoing when it came to playwrights being women than the literary world. So it will help the theater is more easygoing than most places.
Sure.
But she wrote all her plays under Gordon.
That's right. And the first detective novel as well.
I just found that out recently. I did not know she wrote anything under her theatrical name.
I think
that's fascinating.
Well she the first novel was called The Man in the Queue, and that was published under the name Gordon Daviot.
But by the time
she wrote the second novel, Shilling for Candles, which is about 6 years later, she did use the name Josephine Tay. And I think after that, because it had the same detective character, Alan Grant, I think The Man in the Queue was always published under the Josephine Tay name from then on.
Oh, okay. I really love that's another detective I really love, is Alan Grant. I did get a little mad at him. I won't say why because it's a spoiler, but I did get a little mad at him when I read Shilling for Candles. I said, I can't believe you're doing this. I'm talking to a character in a book.
Well, I don't know whether you're familiar with this, Sherry, but Shilling for Candles was actually turned into a film by Alfred Hitchcock.
No, I didn't know that. That's cool.
Yeah, well, it's you're definitely forgiven because the film bears virtually no resemblance to the book. It's a film called Young and Innocent, and it's not really a detective story at all. It's more of a manhunt story. So I think Hitchcock got the idea of the that there's a manhunt element in the book, but he took that and made the film that focus around it. So the actual storyline of the film is very, very different from the story in the book. And I don't think Alan Grant is actually in the film at all. If he is, I can't remember. The film doesn't have a very big part. So it's a totally different exercise, even more so than usual.
Well, Hitchcock does that. I mean, look at 39 Steps.
Yeah.
39 Steps, the book, is very, very different than 39 Steps, the movie.
Yes, that's true. And the other one, of course, is Suspicion.
Oh, yeah.
Based on Anthony Barclay's Before the Fact, Anthony Barclay writing as Francis Isles, and Hitchcock completely changes the ending of that in a pretty dramatic way.
Actually, you know that wasn't Hitchcock that did that? That was the studio, because they didn't want Cary Grant to be playing that character.
He certainly told that story later, but of course it was. He was directing the film, but I think that he certainly went along with the guidance. But it did mean that the film doesn't pack the punch of the novel, which is a very, very dark and powerful novel. Certainly, nothing cozy.
Cary Grant was
about Before the Fact.
Cary Grant was pissed. Because he wanted to do that. He wanted to change his image and, you know, play more deep, dark character roles. And that was the script. And then all of a sudden they changed it. And he was so mad.
It's a bad decision, I would say.
Because you could see him doing it. You could see him playing the part really well. I mean...
I think so.
Because he had all the charm, but he played really creepy people in some other movies, so he could do it. But no, they wanted him to be the hero, and you know, he was handsome and gorgeous, and everybody loved him, and he did a lot of comedy, and he's going to go back to comedy, so he can't be that character.
Yes, it's a strange decision, but...
It's a really good... good movie, but they messed it up at the end.
I think so. The book is terrific, I think.
Hollywood's famous for that.
Yes, of course, and of course it happens on television as well, all the time. So it's not just Hitchcock.
Well, it happened recently. Look at what they did to Halloween Party for the movie with...
It had nothing to do with it. I haven't seen it, but I've read about it. Although, to be fair, the book is definitely not one of Agatha's best, so it may be that I don't know, but it may be that the film script is actually a better story.
But from what I can gather,
it's a very different story.
It's a very different story, but I don't know. It wasn't my cup of tea, let's put it that way.
But
they did was they used the names of the characters from Halloween Party, and that's it.
Yeah.
else. There was nothing to do with Halloween Party other than they used the names of the characters.
Right.
I was like, why are you bothering? Why did you even change the cover of Halloween Party if it had nothing to do with Halloween Party?
Exactly. Yes. Highly commercial. But yes, not true to the book.
Yeah, I was like. Of course, I'm not. I have a great respect for Kenneth Branagh, but I can't stand his Poirot.
No, I'm not a fan either.
I think of all the people who've played... Okay, no, that's not true. He's the second worst Poirot. The worst Poirot is Tony Randall.
Yes, I saw that film recently. It's, I'd wondered about it for a very long time because the first time I read the ABC Murders, it was my grandmother's paperback copy, and it was the film tie-in version with the picture of Tony Randall on the cover.
Really?
So I was aware of the film right from, a very, very young age. But it's you never see it on British television. And then eventually I caught up with it only a few weeks ago because I thought, surely it can't be as bad as everybody says.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, it was.
Uh-huh.
It was just as bad as everybody says it
yeah.
is. I was... my hope that it was a neglected gem was dashed.
Yeah, it's not a gem. Thing is that Tony Randall is an exquisite actor. He really was a great actor. It's just the script. It sucked.
Yeah.
I do not blame him. I mean, they don't have any charm in it. You know, like the Margaret Rutherford movies had very little to do with Miss Marple, but there was so much charm in it. You enjoyed it.
Yeah.
You know, it was fun. There's no charm
that's right.
in
yeah.
it. There's no charm in the Tony Randall ABC. It just wasn't
the alphabet murders.
The yeah. alphabet murders. Yeah. Yeah. They. I think she would have. Agatha would have had an early heart
sure
attack.
She hated it.
Yeah, she was not pleased. I mean, I read that she hated it.
Yeah, I'm not surprised, having seen it.
She loved Margaret Rutherford, but she didn't like the Miss Marple. But she loved her. I mean, it's hard not to love Margaret Rutherford.
Yeah, that's what introduced me to Agatha Christie when I was 8 years old. So I do have a soft spot for the Margaret Rutherford films, even though you're absolutely right, they're nothing to do with the books. But
it's charming.
But they are charming. Yes, you're absolutely right. Yeah.
And she's funny. And they do have it's funny because it doesn't have very much to do with the actual book that Agatha Christie wrote. But there's actually a pretty good mystery in them, you know.
Yeah.
You know, if you like mysteries and you watch it, it's a good comedy and there's a decent mystery in it, you know.
Yeah.
So
yeah, well,
definitely worth watching.
That's how I came to be involved with crime fiction in the first place. The Murder Most Foul was the first one I saw, so I'd never heard of Agatha Christie at that point. So that set me on the path that brings me to speaking to you today. So
my mom sort of introduced me to those movies. She always thought they were fun, and it was the first time I saw it was cut to ribbons because it was the old 3:30 movie on,
right,
an afternoon movie, and it was just they always cut that into about an hour and a half to watching time, which means they took out like hunks of it.
Right.
So, and that's any movie that was on. I mean, I saw a lot of classics with my mom because she used to have us come in and watch it with her and then do her homework because she wanted to introduce us to classics. So all those classics, when I saw them later on TCM, I'm like, oh my God, look at this scene and look at that scene. I never saw that scene before. But they do. But that's the first time I saw Margaret Rutherford in that was on the 3:30 movie. And I just, I loved her. I loved her and her husband. He wasn't in, I mean, they wrote him in because she didn't
yes.
want to do it without him.
Yeah, Stringer Davis, yeah, that's right.
He was adorable.
It's a nice little cameo role for him, wasn't it?
Yeah, he was really fun. Did you ever see a movie called The VIPs?
No.
It's one of those movies with all these movie stars. It has Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton and Rod Taylor and Maggie Smith and all these, and Margaret Rutherford.
Right.
And she steals every scene she's in. She's just It was like watching Helen Hayes in Airport. She's just so great in that movie. I love her. So what new thing? I mean, I know you're writing your books. Anything else new and exciting that's happening?
Yes, I've just announced, in fact, earlier today, that The Life of Crime, which is my history of crime fiction, there's going to be a new edition for the paperback, which is revised and expanded. So it's going to be an even bigger book than the original book. And at the same time, I've announced that HarperCollins have asked me to write a new edition of The Golden Age of Murder, another non-fiction book, to celebrate the 10th anniversary of the first edition. So that will come out sometime next year. So I'm very, very happy about those two things. Those, although they're not novels, they're books that have been very important to me in my writing career. They're books that have brought me in touch with a lot of great people across the world, and have done well as books. So I'm very happy about those two projects. They're, as I say, they're new editions and expanded editions of existing books rather than absolutely new books, but still very, very gratifying. And hard to believe that next year will be the 10th anniversary of the Golden Age of Murder, but that is indeed the case. It was first published in 2015. That's hard for me to credit that.
That's amazing. I read both, and I'm like, I learned so much from those two
Thank you.
books.
Yeah.
And to think that you're going to put more into them is really
Yep.
fascinating and cool.
Yeah. Yes, well, it's always very difficult with books like that, which do have a lot of information, not just in the text, but in the endnotes at the end of each chapter, where I digress and go off on various different tangents about all sorts of things that seem to me to be interesting and entertaining. So I hope that readers will find them interesting and entertaining. But of course, you have to draw the line somewhere. And so this does give me a chance to introduce extra material, particularly stuff that has come to me since the original books were published. So that's it's a great pleasure to have a second opportunity to do that. So a great privilege, and very, very happy that HarperCollins have asked me to do that for both those books.
I think that's fantastic. We're reading your short story collection in Whodunit, The Murder at the Book.
Oh, Murder by the Book. Yes,
Murder by the Book. Sorry, don't have it in front of me.
That's in the British Library Crime Classics series, and that's actually one of the I've probably done probably more than 20 anthologies in that series now, but I think Murder by the Book is one of the best selling of all of them, because people do like stories about books. So, and that's the idea of the anthology, to bring together quite a number of vintage stories by crime writers that in one way or another feature books or manuscripts. So that's the concept behind the anthology.
Well, it's like I thought that A.A. Milne only wrote one mystery, The Red House, and then you're reading this and you find out, oh no, he wrote a short story too.
Yeah, he did. So it's little finds like that that make the job of putting together an anthology very, very fascinating. And it is something, I've over the years, over probably 30 years, I've now edited just over 50 anthologies, nearly all fiction, but one linked to true crime and one about the craft of crime writing, how I've done it, for the Detection Club. But it's always a joy to get the stories in. So if they're new stories for the, for example, for the Crime Writers Anthology, which I edit, the CWA Anthology for this year is called Midsummer Mysteries, and that will be coming out in June.
Ooh.
And it's a great pleasure to receive the stories from some wonderful contemporary writers. The difficult thing is deciding which to pick, because for Midsummer Mysteries I had getting on for 60 stories by experienced authors who are members of the Crime Writers Association, and of course trying to pick 18 or so is really quite a challenge, because
Oh, yeah.
It means that some very good stories don't actually make the cut, but that's the way it is. But that was certainly something very enjoyable to do, and some of the authors were authors I'd not read before, and in fact of the stories in the book, more than half of them are by people who've never had a story in the CWA anthology before, so that's that's very pleasing as well.
That's very interesting.
So I'm happy with that one. And there is another British Library anthology coming out in the summer, which is called Lessons in Crime, which is mystery stories set in the academic world, so school or college, university, that sort of thing. But that's coming out in summer in Britain, and I think it will be some months down the track in the States, because the American editions of the British Library books are usually about 8 or 9 months behind, because they started later, and there's one a month in the States as there is in Britain. So that's something I hope people will look forward to. Again, the academic world is a nice theme for stories. There are quite a lot of novels set around the academic world, but also a number of short stories. Not a colossal number, but plenty. Certainly enough for a good collection like this. So that book is almost ready, but it's not quite ready at the moment. But it's there've been some delays with it, but in the production process. But that's another one I'm looking forward to. So that will come out in the summer, probably a fairly similar time to Midsummer Mysteries.
Cool.
So there'll be one vintage mystery anthology and one contemporary mystery anthology.
I actually have read another one of your anthologies, Blood on the Tracks.
Oh, yes, the railway.
Yeah.
Railway mystery anthology.
I love trains, so that was cool.
Right.
I love trains just as a person going on a train, so it's really always... Did you? I don't know. This is going to sound like a really silly question, but when you were young, did you bring Agatha Christie's train books with you when you knew you were going on a train, like the Blue Train and Murder on the Orient Express?
No, I can't say I did. Murder on the Orient Express is great, but Mystery of the Blue Train, I think, was Agatha's least favourite books, and it's not because she wrote it difficult time in her life, and it's not one of my favorites either, I think that's one of the few that I've not read a second time. I have seen the TV version, but I've not read it for many years,
and
I can't actually remember much about it, to be honest.
And there's another train one, I can't remember the name of it. It was with it was sort of close to the Blue Train, but it was about an Australian lady who was on the train.
Right.
But Because I'm weird. It's just like I had to read Somewhere in Time at the Del Coronado because that's where it was written.
Right.
So right. When I'm on a train, I like to have, not just Agatha, but I like to have a book with a train in it.
Lovely, yeah.
But I also love trains, so I was really enjoying your book because I just love trains.
Good. Well, that was another one that was fun to compile. And as you will know, having read the book, there's a surprising amount of variety.
Yes.
In train mysteries, and that's one of the interesting things about the British Library series, or probably any of the anthologies that I edit, is that you take a particular theme and then you see what different authors do with it. And of course, with the contemporary books that I edit, where it's contemporary stories, very often, not always, but very often I will write a story, and typically what I'll do is wait until I've got most of the other stories in, so I can do something that's a bit different from the other stories, and that's always a fun challenge. And the story I wrote for Midsummer Mysteries is a story called The Widow, and it was the basic idea was one I'd had for quite a while, but then I went to a festival in a place called Berwick-on-Tweed, right on the border between England and Scotland. And that struck me. I had a good time when I went to Berwick, and it struck me as a very interesting, it's a very historic place, very interesting place on the coast. And so I decided to use that as the setting for the mystery, the story of The Widow, and try to use in the story this thing of being on the border, so not quite Scotland, not quite England, that kind of idea was interesting, and I set it in summer, and summer plays a part in the storyline, so it was a fun thing to do for me, as well as reading all the other stories that were sent in.
Well, when I was a kid, I live in California, and our neighbor's Mexico. And when I was a kid, to me, this is going to sound terrible, Mexico meant going to Tijuana and getting great deals on all kinds of stuff. But when I got older, I got to go to Mexico and got actually see the beautiful cities in Mexico, like Acapulco and places like that, Mexico City. But when I was a kid, to me, because that's right, Tijuana is not right on the border, but darn close.
Yes. When I went on the bus trip, the trolley trip from San Diego, which I know is where you live, they said at one point you could actually see Tijuana from the trolley bus, so that was a surprise.
Yeah, it's interesting because there's like in San Diego, there's a lot of like woods and nature between California and San Diego, but then you see a little bit of Tijuana as you're flying by. It just it's kind of ruins the nature thing.
Well, it's a very interesting. I found it fascinating on my visit, and I really enjoyed it. I went to La Jolla, mm-hmm. where Raymond Chandler used to live, so mm-hmm. I went on a pilgrimage to La Jolla. So that was good. So yeah, it was a really great trip.
Yeah, I love La Jolla, and you say it right. I'm so proud of you.
Yeah,
you don't know how many people I've heard call it La Jolla, because that's the way it's spelled. I mean, I can understand.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Yes. Well, I will confess that in the past, before I found out, that's what I used to call it. But I have learned better now.
Yeah, you said it right. I'm going, yay, Martin, because it always annoyed me. I was born in Los Angeles. I was raised in Los Angeles. I was born in Orange County. So even though I was born there, I knew how to pronounce the names of the different cities in California. So it always bothered me when somebody called it La Jolla.
Well, I can see why Chandler liked living there.
That's beautiful.
That's for sure.
It's beautiful. Did you go to the Playhouse?
No, just went on a short trip, really, just a sightseeing trip round the looking at the seals and the nature, and then going on a walk round, really. So it was like half a day visit, which isn't very long, but it was quite memorable. It sort of sticks in my mind very, very vividly indeed. Yes, I enjoyed it.
Yeah, the La Jolla Playhouse is very famous. It had a lot
Right.
of movie stars came from there and
Right.
started and TV stars started their
Right.
careers there. I mean, from I don't know if you watched I Love Lucy, but Vivian Vance,
Yes, Lucille Ball, yeah.
yeah, Vivian Vance, who plays Ethel, she was discovered by Desi Arnaz at La Jolla Playhouse playing very
Right.
different character than Ethel, but she was kind of a
Right.
nasty character. But but her looks was perfect for
Right.
playing Ethel, and yeah, that's how she got the part was,
Right.
yeah. But isn't that interesting? I mean, you never know what's going to happen especially when you're in the theater. But I thought that was kind of a cool story. Both Vivian Vance and Desi Arnaz talk about their different sides of it. She almost turned it down because she was playing an older person. You know, she's playing older. She was younger than what Ethel was supposed to be, because Ethel was supposed to be closer to William Frawley's age. You know, Fred.
Right. To be honest, all I remember, because I was very, very small when it was shown in Britain, all I remember is Lucille Ball, and Desi Arnaz was the husband, wasn't he?
Yes.
So that it it's I enjoyed watching it, but it's a very, very distant memory, I must say.
Okay. I was just trying
Very
to explain about how different Vivian was in real life than
distant.
the character. I mean, sort of normal. Lucy wasn't anything like Lucy Ricardo, so
Right.
I don't think anybody in life would be anything like Lucy Ricardo.
I did read somewhere quite recently that the name Ricardo came because someone involved was a great admirer of David Ricardo, the economic thinker. So that struck me as a strange little bit of trivia,
I
but
think that
whether
probably
it's true or
was
not, I don't know.
the producer and head writer,
Right.
Oppenheimer. It was
Right.
probably him because he was quite an
Right.
intellectual.
Right, right, right,
So that was
right,
probably
right.
one of his little things. But people don't
Right.
realize Desi Arnaz wasn't just playing Ricky. He was actually the producer.
Right.
He's the one who created the three camera. Well, him with an expert who was a cinematographer from Lucy's film days when she was at RKO came and helped him. The two of them created a three camera method that we still use today.
All right.
Yeah, so Desi was actually really important in the industry. People just didn't know that because they only thought of
Right.
him as a husband.
Right. Yeah, wasn't there something at the Desilu Productions,
Right.
which was Desi and Lucille? Yeah, that's something that sticks in my memory from the credits, but pretty much everything else is I've forgotten, I must admit.
Do you know that that was named after their home?
No,
Back
no.
in the old days, the estates were named, and theirs wasn't a big place. It was a smaller place. It wasn't like a real estate. It became one later, but
Right.
it was like a farm, and
Right.
they named it Desi Lou,
Right.
Desi and Lucy, And yeah. that's and they said that's what they named the production company. They named it after right. their home.
Right. Interesting.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah. I actually really love that show, even though it's been, I know some people, I every once in a while when I'm depressed or I want to be cheered up, because it's still funny.
I mean, that's what I remember as a small child, that it used to amuse me. And that is what sticks in my mind.
Did you know that, this is something Desi said, you know the canned laughter in I Love Lucy? That the audience, it wasn't really canned laughter. That was the live audience that was laughing. They used that as canned laughter for years on CBS. You can actually, if you watch an old TV show, comedy on CBS, and they have canned laughter in it, you can actually hear Desi Arnaz laughing because he had a very distinctive laugh.
Right.
He's because they it was years later and he was going around about his book and they asked him what is the biggest legacy from your show, and he goes, the laughter and that people that CBS keeps using, that's the biggest legacy.
Yeah.
I thought it was funny. we're coming to the end. I wanted to know if do you have any events or anything that are coming up that you want people to know about?
Well, I've got a lot of events in England this year. I'm doing various libraries in places like Cumberland, Westmorland, Wirral, Warrington. I'm also doing the Crimefest Festival at Bristol, which is a very, very good one. That's in May, next month. And I'm doing festivals in Richmond, in Yorkshire, and hopefully the Isle of Man in September. And I am coming over to the States, to Nashville this time, to BouchCon, at the beginning of September. So I'm looking forward to that trip as well. So a lot happening, and the real challenge will be finding enough time to write all the things I want to write in between all these trips to different events. But the mix is great fun, and you know, I'm very lucky to have the opportunity to do that. So I'm trying to make the most of it.
Cool. And do you have a website so people can find where you're going to be doing these events, you know, to find out where to sign up and all that stuff?
I am a bit remiss with my website, to be perfectly honest. That's one of the casualties of my other activities, all the writing and so on. But that is something I do need to get round to. I'm on Twitter as M. Edwards Books. I'm on Facebook. Martin Edwards Books is the author page. People who are interested can certainly track me down on the internet for sure.
Cool. I want to thank you for taking time out of your day for chatting with me. I really appreciate you coming back on the show.
Well, thanks so much for inviting me again and for arranging an early show to accommodate the British time difference. So lovely to chat to you again, Sherry. Thanks very much.
Thank you. And thank you for chatting with Sherry.
Thanks.